Welcome back to the latest episode of the Leadership Caffeine Podcast. You know, this is a really special episode for me. I've got someone who I hold in such incredible regard. We've got Dave Brock here today. Dave, in my estimation, is the dean of sales executives and sales strategists in our world today. He's the author of a fabulous book, The Sales Manager Survival Guide, and a forthcoming book, which we're going to talk to him about. And you know, most of all, he's a friend. He's that person that I turn to when I need the expertise and the wisdom that he has from, I don't know, thousands and thousands of sales engagement and experience across the tech sector and experience around the world. So with that very short introduction, Dave, welcome.
Well, thank you, Art. I you all of a sudden intimidated me because I don't know that I can live up to that setup you gave me. So thank you so much. I've been really looking forward to this, participating in this. You've had such great guests and content in the past. I hope I can live up to the standard that you've
set. I have no doubt about it. And it's really fun to talk sales for a while. A lot of the content I navigate in is leadership and more broader, you know, general management oriented. But I am by background passionate about the world of selling. I think if I had to describe, I've never really been a great sales representative, but I've had some phenomenal sales and marketing teams under my umbrella. Yep. So maybe a little bit of competence at bringing those audiences together. So this feels really good. It feels close to home here. You know, let's just start and go big right away. I'm interested in your perspective on what the big macro trends are out there that are kind of changing the world of sales. And, you know, technology jumps to mind is one of those. But what are the big things you're seeing out there and how are they affecting the world of selling, particularly in B2B selling?
So I'm going to kind of reset this and start from maybe a different point, because all the conversations that I typically get into about selling are about us as salespeople, sales leaders, sales managers, the technology and tools that we do and so on and so forth. And it's you know, basically what we inflict on our customers.
Right.
And but I think the more meaningful thing to look at is what are our customers facing? You know, what's happening to them, and then what does that mean to us as sales professionals and how we intersect our customers most effectively and with greater impact?
The customers are no doubt constantly being disrupted, navigating all sorts of uncertainty, dealing with technology and competitors from different sources. And yeah, their worlds are turned upside down, and it's got to be interesting to be a sales representative as well.
And that's exactly it. If you look at all our customers, I use the word turbulence, and turbulence kind of encompasses complexity, massive change, disruption, changing business models, confusion, risk, and all those sorts of things. And that's happening both at a market level, an organizational level, and at a personal level. Mm-hmm. And so what you see is our customers are really struggling. You see a lot of data, you know, Gartner data that increasingly shows the difficulty customers have reaching a buying decision. You see some other data, Mort Hansen has done a lot of work on this about how things aren't getting done in organizations, and it's the convergence of all these things onto the organizations and onto the individuals, and they're really struggling. Mm-hmm. And that struggle creates the huge opportunity for sales, and that's why I am so optimistic about the future of sales and what we can contribute to helping our customers achieve their objectives. They're just, you know, the concept I talk about is they're just trying to make sense of what they're trying to face. Mm-hmm. And the degree to which we as salespeople can come in and rather than pitching them our products is really talking to them about what are you trying to achieve? How can I help you think about that? How can I help you sort through that? And through that, you know, show how my products and services can help you achieve those things. So it's this whole concept of sense making.
Is that much different than a lot of the selling processes have been suggesting forever, that we really do focus on those problems instead of trying to pitch our wares?
A slightly different context, because a lot of the sales process is ones that you and I kind of grew up on customer focused selling, solution selling,
concentrated very in flavors of vanilla, by the way.
Yeah, but all of, and even, you know, more currently, things like insight and challenger selling, you know, all of those tended to focus on the solution, the end state that the customer is trying to get to. But what we find is customers don't know how to buy. Mm-hmm. And so from a sales point of view, the value that we create is actually in that process of figuring out what problems they're trying to solve and help them, guide them through how do we organize ourselves to solve this? You know, how do we move forward? How do we develop a project management for both the problem we're trying to solve, what we're trying to buy, and how do we move through that? So it becomes less focused on the solution, but more the process for getting to that solution.
Yeah, I love that phrasing, the customers don't know how to buy. I mean, that's a compelling challenge, and maybe one that didn't exist, at least in the level of complexity it's there today, a decade or two ago.
Well, the data shows 55% of customer buying decisions end in no decision made. And that's not because they don't know how to select a solution. It's they just can't organize themselves to buy and navigate their way through that buying process. You overlay that on top, and again, some of Mort Hansen's data is really interesting on this, is that internal project failure, their ability to, customers' abilities to manage themselves to achieve things are becoming increasingly difficult. And again, it's all these converging factors of turbulence, complexity, change, and all that kind of thing that impact that. They're smart people, but they're struggling with doing their jobs.
Gotcha. All right, so you did a nice, a very, very good, pertinent redirect on me. Back at you. So how is AI affecting or looking to affect the world of selling and buying?
I think the promise of AI is really great. I think people really misunderstand AI. Mm-hmm. And they misunderstand where it works and where it doesn't work. I mean, currently, as we look at AI, and as we look at AI probably over the next 5 to 10 years, you know, what AI is really terrific at is pattern recognition. Sure. You know, so it can start helping us identify patterns and things that would have been difficult or impossible for us as human beings to understand, even with kind of complex analytics and so on and so mm-hmm. forth. But the big thing that AI doesn't do is AI doesn't enable us to look at a specific context, a specific situation. You know, what is it, Art, that you're facing right now today? What's challenging you? You know, what side of the bed did you get out of today, and how do you feel? And how do I help you move forward with that? AI is completely incapable of addressing that contextual, time-specific, individual-specific kind of issues that customers are facing right now. Sure. And again, that's the promise of salespeople intersecting with AI. AI can give me a lot of background. It can help me kind of tune in and say, here's probably what Art's feeling about right now. Here's some things that might be concerning him. But then how do I translate that to something that's contextually and time-wise relevant to what you're doing right now? And how do I make that people-to-people connection?
Right. Well said. You need to write more about that, Dave. So I know you've written some about it. That's fabulous. AI certainly can learn to play a mean game of chess, or as we've learned, can learn to play a great game of Go and beat the best in the world. But trying to figure out the emotional state of humans and impose inference on that, very, very difficult at this point.
Yeah, and well, we've seen all sorts. I mean, Microsoft had a famous failure several years ago where you know, the AI was starting to train itself on some things that, and all of a sudden started coming out with a number of racist reactions, right. predictions, right. and so on and so forth. So we have to do that. You know, I do have to say that I see we're at kind of almost a we can go this direction or this direction. There are increasingly a lot of buying that is very transactional oriented. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something where the customers have bought before, they understand what they're buying very well. It's not a complex buying process. It's a very transactional process. Ultimately, I believe AI will take that over, because we forget that not only is we as salespeople are developing AI tools, but buyers are developing AI tools to help them buy much more effectively,
right, right.
and much more efficiently. So ultimately, the most efficient way of buying is for my bot to communicate with your bot and you know, completely automate that process. And this isn't new. We've had EDI and we've had electronic marketplaces and things like that for years and years. So it's a step beyond that. But the real issue that customers are facing is this issue of complexity. Mm-hmm. And AI isn't structured to, it's structured to help us with that, but not help, you know, manage that person to person. You know, how can I help you move forward?
Sure, sure. Are you seeing organizations doing a better job these days leveraging the power of all of the data that we have at our disposal and all of the analytics systems and tools that exist in organizations? Are you seeing them actually mine that and leverage that for success, or are we still kind of playing with it?
Absolutely not. I mean, it's you know, even the most powerful organism, the biggest and most experienced organizations are still struggling with this. I mean, we're still, while we may be leveraging AI tools, we aren't leveraging them for their full benefit. Mm-hmm. You know, we're even still struggling with you know, complex analytics. You know, things like, look at your email inbox when you start work in the morning. And my guess is it's filled with a huge number of irrelevant communications of somebody trying to reach out to you and sell you something and so on and so forth. You know, we've long had the marketing automation tools that allow us to slice and dice and segment our right. customers very, very effectively and get the right message to the right customer at the right time, but we aren't using it.
Right.
And part of that is you know, I'll be harsh here, is laziness on the part of marketing and sales professionals, and all because it's just easier to blast the world with emails rather than to say, well, here's Art's profile. Let me just get these messages to him in a meaningful way. And also the tools that we've had for years, we aren't using or we're using poorly.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, so your word laziness, I was going to ask if ignorance and apathy were the ones that were showing up, and maybe it's ignorance and laziness that are keeping marketers and selling professionals from leveraging those tools.
Those are really harsh words, but I actually believe that, because yeah. Look, as simple as marketing automation is, and marketing automation has been, sophisticated marketing automation tools have been around forever, but are people using the capabilities that are embedded in those? Absolutely not.
One of the things that you do regularly, and I find myself chuckling, and I know a lot of folks do, is you, some hapless marketer or business development rep uses LinkedIn or email marketing to attempt to reach out to you.
Yeah.
For all sorts of interesting things that are completely irrelevant and showcase that they really are ignorant of who you are and what your profile is. And you pretty much eviscerate them, or at least eviscerate the practice, not necessarily yeah. the people. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I'm what I see every day is not that we don't know what to do, not that we don't know how to do it, but for some reason we just fail to do it.
Right.
You know, so for instance, You know, if I look at it at an organizational level, you know, I walk into any organization, whether it's a startup company or a global 100 company, you know, and they all have a CRM system. Mm-hmm. They all have a sales process. They've probably spent millions of dollars in sales training and methodologies and things like that. They have a lot of tools in place. They do pipeline reviews, deal reviews, account reviews, and so on and so forth. They have all those things in place, except they aren't using it. You know, what's the data on CRM compliance right now? CRM compliance is I think in the 20s, 20%. You know, and it's they have these tools, but they aren't using it. You know, and so the biggest thing, the data around sales training, you know, the half-life of sales training is, you know, regardless of the vendor that's provided it, is within about 60 days, people aren't using it. They've gone back and reverted for various reasons to what they always did before.
Sure.
You know, so what we find is less an issue of what to do and how to do it and why we're doing it, but how do we create those consistent habits of actually executing on that?
Right. So if you're a top sales executive today, what's keeping you awake at night?
Probably too much wine than the year before, but
okay. Beyond that, what are the issues? What are the things that are renting space in your mind that you're just really concerned about in helping your organization and your team adapt and succeed in this world?
It is, if I'm an astute sales executive, what's keeping me up at night is how do I help my organization help their manage the change that customers are going through and truly engage the customer with what they care about, not what we care about. Just before this call, I was on a call on, it's a very, very large deal. It's about $150 million deal one of my clients is looking at, very complex. And they kept talking about it. And finally, I interrupted it and I said, all I hear you talking about is what you do. What does the customer care about and what do they do? How do you change this conversation to be all about what the customer does? And it was one of those kind of aha moments that said, you know, it's a change in context, a change in the way we approach things. So that, you know, that fundamentally is one thing. But as a sales executive, the things that we see impact sales organizations right now in the future, culture and talent, and values. You know, if I don't have an organization with the kind of culture, the mindset, the value system, if I don't have the talent that I need, all the tools and all the stuff and all the processes we put in place won't work. I mean, we're facing a terrible thing today, is that the average tenure of salespeople and sales leaders in an organization is 16 and a half months.
That's miserable. Why?
Well, and it's I think it's because we aren't creating workplaces where people want to feel valued and want to work. You know, so as you mentioned the next book, The Sales Executive Survival Guide, about 30% of the book is really focused on culture, values, and talent. Is those are kind of the raw ingredients. Peter Drucker, who you and I both respect tremendously, you know, says culture eats strategy for breakfast.
And lunch.
and we haven't focused on that very much. And you just look at kind of the math of this. If I have people that are only around for 16 and a half months, you know, even in some of the most trivial sales processes, you know, what's my onboarding time? How long does it take them to ramp up and get productive? What's my sales cycle? So on and so forth, is they aren't around long enough to actually start executing. Or a new sale, and you and I have been in the situation where new managers come in. A new manager comes in, they believe they have to change things and fix things. you know, so it takes them 90 days or so to figure out what to change. Then they start putting that in place and poof, they're gone before they've actually started producing results. And another manager comes in and does the same thing again. And the salespeople just keep their heads down and say, this too will pass. Mm-hmm. So to me, while there's a lot of focus on sales automation, sales technology, sales tools, sales training, and this, how do we engage customers? And that's important. We pretty much have that figured out. But one of the key reasons we're not succeeding is we aren't creating workplaces that have the culture, the value system, and the talent aligned with that, that allow us to perform.
Sounds like some real leadership stuff there.
It's all leadership stuff. I mean, it's a customer I'm working with right now. They're a multi-billion dollar corporation. There's about 1,000 salespeople in the organization. And a new sales executive was brought in to kind of turn this organization around. And he did an assessment of on a variety of performance factors, performance against quota, you know, performance against everything. 95%+ of the salespeople, he did a red, yellow, green thing. 95%+ of the salespeople ended up with lots of red dots in the analysis there. You know, and I asked him, I said, what does that tell you? And he was right on with his assessment. He says, we don't have a salesperson problem. We have a leadership problem because you can't have 95% of your salespeople failing because they're just bad salespeople. They may be bad salespeople, but we hired the wrong people, or they may be, you know, they may not be performing because they don't know what to do, how to do it, and we aren't leading them and coaching them and so on and so forth. So it all becomes a sales leadership problem.
Well, and this is classic Deming stuff going way back. Deming was just that incredible advocate for, hey, look, if things aren't going right, if that's happening, it's the system. And by the way, management owns creating the system. In his case, he meant management and leadership. And the system is failing these people.
Exactly. And that's it. And so you go back to, well, what skills and competencies do we start needing to address those? And we need things like critical thinking in systems thinking and all those things that Deming put in place and that we know to work. And we need to really get deep into that. And then as you start looking at it, it's all based on the cultures and the values that you try and create, and then getting people that fit that culture and value. A story I always tell is when I started my career is I started my career as a salesperson in IBM. And at that time in the early 80s at IBM, it was a very tough environment, very tough, very results focused. Mm-hmm. We had this internal process of contention management is, you know, you'd get the best people in a room arguing strongly for their own ideas. We'd come to a conclusion and then we'd walk out together and execute what we decided on. But that was a tough, rough and tumble environment. That culture fit what I wanted to do and how I wanted to work. And as a result, I thrived in it. There are some people that IBM hired that didn't like that, and they failed. And that culture worked for IBM. It didn't necessarily work for another company and so on. And I learned that when I went to do a turnaround at another company. I took my rough and tumble IBM approach into this amiable, relationship-oriented thing. And I almost failed until I recognized it was a different culture.
Right, yeah.
So there are all these things happening. But as you get back to it, it is leadership. It is leadership, it is discipline, it's critical thinking, it's execution. It is not just sales leadership, but it's executive management as well.
So what does that sales executive need from senior leadership, from CEO as support to make it work in this world?
I think, well, the first thing is, one, to value the sales function. Is I don't know how many organizations I go into where for whatever reasons, the sales function is not valued. You know
what I hear or get the impression it's viewed as either a cost or an annoyance or a necessary evil. And those are all harsh words, I know, but that's kind of the feeling you get, and you just scratch your head and wonder where that thinking comes from.
Well, you know, and I don't know where that thinking comes from. I mean, a lot of it, I think, comes from, you know, I work with a lot of technology startups and so on and so forth. Right. And there's this hot product syndrome, you know, and the product is hot, it sells itself. But, you know, it is, and it's interesting. I saw something by a very good venture capital company the other day, talked about product-led growth. And they talked about all these superstars of today that have hot products and that are doing double, triple digit growth. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, gee, you know, I'm old enough to remember companies like Digital Equipment Corporation, Wang Labs, Sun Microsystems, you know, all those companies that I used to compete against that had hot, hot, hot products. And there's a certain point where products aren't hot enough.
Yeah, they run out of gas. They quit fueling the growth. For a lot of people, those names, if they've even encountered those names, are in the history books or the and they're dusty old management books because they're not names we know anymore.
Right, and the number of companies that can in fact develop hot products is actually very small as well.
Right. Sure.
So I think some of it you have management that comes and says, we're a product-driven company and we have hot products and all we have to do is get those hot products in front of the customers and they don't value sales. There are others that look at sales strictly as an expense, mm-hmm. you know, and don't look at sales as a revenue point, how sales drives and generates revenue. There are others that simply don't understand or don't care about their customers and don't understand what customers go through in acquiring the products and services and how best to engage the customers. And all mm-hmm. is there's so much of this inside out kind of thinking where you know, we optimize our organizations and sales executives do that and CEOs do this. We optimize our organizations around our processes, around our investments, our spending. Mm-hmm. We don't optimize around the customer's buying process.
Yeah, you're consistent in that. All right, so let's shift gears for a second. I read an interesting article recently, the Harvard Business Review, from some people I hold in high regard, Zoltner, Sinha, and Lorimer, who are all part of ZS Associates, as well as Zoltner's. I've actually taken the selling course from him at Kellogg Northwestern. So mm-hmm. I know you have your IBM glass. I've got my Kellogg glass here. So we should be getting product placement money here, Dave.
Right.
You know, and their perspective was, hey, you know what? The unbelievable available of technology is maybe changing the balance away from the field sales representative towards the inside sales representative. Are you seeing that kind of either tug of war or shift going on in certain types of organizations?
And I've read that article and I think there is, I think there's a misunderstanding of the dynamic that's happening with customers.
Okay.
I think there is so much focus on, for instance, the SaaS selling process and
sure.
things around
right.
the predictable revenue or the XaaS selling process and so on and so forth. And where they're correct is technology is helping a lot on these buying processes that are highly transactionalized.
Mm-hmm.
And so those buying process that are highly transactionalized, AI and automation provides huge benefit to it. And as I forecast is those should be 100% automated.
Right.
It's better for the customer. It's better for us. Those will be 100% automated. But I think what they're missing is the dynamic. And most of my focus is on very, very complex buying. Mm-hmm. And as a result, very, very complex selling is they're missing the dynamic of what's happening in organizations, what's happening with this whole thing around complexity, disruption, change. We talk about transformation, both transformation normally and digitally and so on and so forth. And how are people equipped to be able to understand this, manage it, and deal with that? Is those are the domain of very, very complex problems. Mm-hmm. And while technology can help us better understand those, technology has real limitations in helping us, currently has real limitations in helping us actually work with customers and take action and move forward with it.
Sure.
And so you see a whole new skill set. I think I spoke to you about it earlier. There's a gentleman by the name of David Snowden who was an ex-IBM researcher, and he's now established his own company. But he really is looking at how do we characterize our world of kind of simpler transactional, maybe complicated, complex, and chaotic. And as we look at those kinds of dimensions in his framework, how we work with and how we engage the customer in each one of those quadrants is very different. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, as we look at smart business people and smart sales executives, as we start looking at our customer engagement strategies, we have to start looking, where do our customers fit? And how do we design our processes to engage them where they're at, whether they're in the complex domain, the complicated domain, or the simple domain? And those are very different solutions, and they may coexist within the same company. So Salesforce.com is a great example of it. The way Salesforce.com got started and did very, very well was by changing the CRM buying process from a complex enterprise buying process to an individual transactional process. You know, I remember Salesforce calling me up in the late 90s and said, you know, for $65 a month, you can have your own CRM system. You don't have to worry about we'll host it and all that kind of thing. You don't have to worry about IT. And I signed myself up and my team up because it was really good. Uh-huh. And Salesforce had the brilliance of saying, how do we make this simple? How do we, rather than getting 10,000 seats at one time, look at getting the one or two in or the small department? And they made it a simple transactional decision, and they are the true masters of that.
Right.
But then as their strategy progressed, they started saying, well, there's another buying domain. How do we go after the 7-Elevens in Japan or so on and so forth and get 10,000, 20,000 seats at a time? And that's a different, more complicated or complex process. And so as you look at how they organize themselves to sell, they have various different ways to address where their customers are at, not only from an industry perspective and so on, but from a simple transactional perspective to a complicated perspective to a complex perspective. And I believe depending on our product set and the breadth of our product set, we have to be prepared to address all those domains.
I'd love to host that coffee between yourself and the group that wrote that article. I think that'd be a fun discussion. So well said. They obviously didn't think about it at the level of depth that you just described it.
Well, again, I think a lot of this is we kind of narrow our perspectives.
Yeah.
And I see this particularly from the technology vendor world, is the technology vendor optimizes their solution to that.
Right.
Certain domain, and so all problems look the same. Is I sell hammers.
yeah, right. You know, everything looks like a nail. Yep.
yeah, all problems look like that, even though you know you may have it may look different from another perspective.
All right. So, as just a little sidebar for anybody watching this on video, you might have watched Dave's eyes kind of shift a little bit as he noticed that my stupid cat walked in the room. The cat has a 100% probability of walking in my office every time I'm doing a podcast interview, Dave. So he's just part of the crew here, okay?
Well, I had to close my office door because I have two cats and they commonly come and stare into the camera. And what is this thing?
Dave, that might be a little creepy. Yeah, yeah. Zen just hangs out at my feet, so I'm reaching down to rub him, but he likes to announce himself. All right, off of that sidebar. If you were on audio, you didn't know that happened. I had chatted with you recently and mentioned, you know, I have two great young sons, 31, 28, both are in sales, and I love it. And they're actually both having great success. And then I think even earlier, you know, earlier in that kind of pipeline coming out of college or individuals in college, what is it that, you know, emerging or, you know, sales professionals, young sales professionals, what should they be doing to prepare to succeed in this world? What's your counsel to them?
Well, and I would generalize this to every sales professional, whether they're new to the career or experienced, or whether they're senior sales leaders, is one is constantly learn and constantly, you know, tune yourself and develop your skills and so on and so forth. It's sad, but the number of people that I see that aren't continually learning, aren't continually reading, aren't continually trying to apply new processes. The world is changing fast, and if you aren't changing with it, you're going to be left behind. You know, I think from a young person coming out of college, clearly you're going to be in an entry-level position and something like that. Most likely you're going to be in an SDR position. Mm-hmm. You know, unfortunately, you know, I forecast probably SDRs will be a thing of the past in the next 5 years, because most of what SDRs are doing is doing the very front end of the sales process in something that's very transactional, where they're most successful is where they're very transactional. And also, I would look at saying, how do I get myself into an account management role as quickly as possible? How do I start learning how to actually engage the customer in meaningful conversations? You know, those kinds of things. I wouldn't become enamored with the technology, but I'd look at how does the technology help me be better, both first more efficient and perhaps more productive, but then how does the technology help me be more effective?
I love that guidance. I can't wait to share it with my sons. What would you counsel on industry selection? So I have one that's in an arena where I suspect it could easily be automated out of existence. I suppose easily is a strong term, but within a few years, there's no reason why that function, effectively logistics, buying space on trucks as a vendor, seems like it's open to that type of disruption. Whereas the other one in the medical devices industry, maybe a little less, a little less likely of being rendered obsolete, at least in the industry. So is choice of industry critical in your estimation?
So this, no, not not really, but I'll offer an opinion that may surprise you. Is where I see the greatest innovation in selling and selling skills is in highly commoditized products.
Interesting.
You know, so I have a number of clients who are in basic materials. Mm-hmm. One of them supplies, you know, carbon, you know, basic chemicals, carbon, oil, and those kinds of things, where you say, our product isn't differentiated. Mm-hmm. Or you can look at this even in semiconductors, because fundamentally semiconductors are just glorified pieces of sand. And you know, so you see this in the semiconductor world is how do I learn to excel at sales when it's not my product that's differentiated, but it's how I engage the customer. Yeah. And how I help them solve their problems. So what I find when I look for innovation in selling is I look at the spaces where it's basic materials, it's commoditized stuff, because they aren't relying on the product to sell itself, but they're relying on some other things. What's the logistics management chain? You know, how do we help? You know, I have a client in Denmark who their foundation was they were a brewery and they developed yeast for breweries, but now yeast is used in detergent, in bread, in beverages, all sorts of things. And it's very commoditized. And, you know, and they decided we're going to engage our customers in different ways. And the brilliance of what they do from a selling point of view is huge, and you can take a lot of lessons there. Where, you know, I worry about an entry-level salesperson is, let me go into hot technology company and SaaS company where they are leveraging off the product and the you know, a hot product kind of syndrome and so on and so forth. They don't have to learn how to sell because the product is doing 90% of it themselves.
You know, I love the challenge to think differently about this situation. And by the way, if you don't have enough work on your plate, I know you're working on the sales executive, the sales executive survival guide?
Correct.
Okay. And that'll be a much welcome follow-on to sales manager survival guide. How about the early sales professional career guide? I think we just created a new project for you here.
I've been looking for the next book beyond that. So yeah.
All right. I'd like to raise that as a candidate topic.
Right. Okay. Now, does that mean I have to share royalties with you?
So. No. You're good to go. You're good to go. So Sales Manager Survival Guide, it's been out a couple of years now. And in my estimation, it's the single best book for that individual who's stepping into the role, or even someone who's been there for a while that wants to get great in managing that frontline sales teams. What's the feedback been? What's your experience been with the book?
The feedback has been really gratifying. I wrote it really, the reason I wrote it is I meet with all these frontline sales managers, some brand new, some very experienced, and they were just struggling with what their job is. Mm-hmm. And how to do their job most effectively and so on. Some have been fantastic salespeople and thrust into this job and so on and so forth. But, you know, there wasn't at the time a whole lot of great training or guidance or great attention to frontline sales managers. I joked in the book about saying, you know, typically the way a sales manager is onboarded is their boss says, congratulations on the promotion or becoming sales manager here. I need your forecast by Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And that's their onboarding process. And so I really wrote this as a practical day-to-day guide for sales managers about how they should think, how they should start doing some things. And as I go around and visit clients, you know, you see them on their desk. You know, the thing is, I tell them to buy a new book because it's so tattered and, you know, there are yellow stickies in it and there are all sorts of notes. And also I know they're using it the way I intended it to be used.
It is truly that desktop guide. Yeah, no doubt about it. And that's got to be just a wonderful feeling for you with so much of your experience and wisdom passed into that book that to see it being used and applied.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it gives you a huge amount of empathy for the struggle that frontline managers have. Sales management isn't an easy job. They don't necessarily get a lot of guidance from their leaders, which is a problem. But you and I have talked about this before. Lots of times I go and ask a sales manager, what's your job? And they look at me kind of cross-eyed and say, well, you're an old gray-haired guy. How come you're asking this question? And I say, well, humor me, what's your job? And they said, well, to make the numbers. And I said, that isn't your job. It's your people's job to make the numbers.
Right.
And what you as a manager are supposed to do is everything you can do to maximize their performance, whether it's coaching and developing them, whether it's removing the roadblocks and the barriers that they have, or providing them the tools and so on and so forth. But your people's job is to make the numbers, and you are the person that enables them to do that. And just that kind of clarity, all of a sudden you start getting some aha moments.
It's a frame shift, right? Just a different.
Exactly.
Yeah. I have to imagine, I was listening to your description of the answer that you hear, that way too many people give you that answer to make the numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's kind of, you know, it's kind of the culture. And I probably would have answered that, you know, right. up until before I wrote the book. But, you know, it really is, you know, how does a sales manager possibly make the numbers? If you look at, you know, maybe they were an individual contributor and maybe they made $1 million, were hitting their quota, making $1 million a year and so on and so forth. And now the data shows they're probably reaching 12 people. And so their numbers are maybe $12 million. And if their job is to make the numbers, you know, what they, you know, they were 150% busy trying to do $1 million as an individual contributor. Now, if they start saying, I got to make $12 million and I got to fill the gap for my salespeople, that equation just doesn't close.
Right.
And they aren't doing their salespeople. So,
I'm curious. I mean, someone who writes so prolifically, love your cadence. I'm awestruck at the cadence of content that you generate out there for all of us. It's fabulous. Who do you look to for inspiration? What are the books you go back to over and over again? And by the way, Wally Bach and I want to know, because we do that Leadership and Management Book Talk podcast, and we're really interested in things that people reread for ideas and insights.
Yeah, frankly, I don't look within the sales profession for that. I look outside the sales profession. I was commenting on the podcast that you and Wally did on General Mattis's book, and that provided me, you know, some incentive to read the book. And all of a sudden, I was extracting lessons that Mattis had, for instance, in a lot of the Middle East conflicts that he was managing. Is, you know, how do you take those lessons, which are truly life and death and world changing, how do you take those lessons and extract something that a CEO can use or an executive can use or so on and so forth? Or, you know, one of my favorite, I just wrote an article about this, is one of my favorite books was actually written in 1963. I reread it at least one time every year. It's called Excellence. It's by John Gardner.
John Gardner, right. Yeah. I read your article this morning on that.
Well, yeah. And in that, there's this phrase that says, do not let form triumph over substance. Well, unfortunately, what I run across every day is form is triumphing over substance.
So what are examples of that? I love the phrase. I love the philosophy behind it. What is it that you're seeing where form is beating substance?
So CRM is a great example. Is we have a CRM system, our people aren't using it, but what we've never taught them to, we've taught them the keystrokes they need to use a CRM system, but we haven't taught them this is how you can use this system to help you become more productive. This is how you can use the system to help you become more efficient. This is how you can use the system to help you win more business. You know, so that's, we have the form of the CRM system, and it's every salesperson's moral obligation to complain about, you know, data entry. But we haven't taught them how to use the system to make it better. So the substance of it. You know, things like you know, there's a lot about, you know, these conversations that we've had. We script the conversations, but we haven't taught them about why are we asking them these things? What does it mean? How do I, you know, we don't get into the why, the how, the what of those things. So you have people, you know, executing blindly. And they stop after the first objection. I had somebody call me up from a very big company, and they had done some analysis. I think they said, you know, they called me up and they asked me if I was CEO. I said, yes, I'm the CEO. And they said, well, we've done some analysis on your company, and we believe you're underperforming your potential by 25%.
Like, wow. Holy cow.
Cool. That's really interesting. What am I doing wrong? And the person said, well, we'd like to schedule a demo.
Oops.
And I said, no, wait a minute. You said something very provocative. You said I'm underperforming my potential by 25%. What am I doing wrong? And, you know, and the person wasn't equipped to deal with that. And that killed this individual because they immediately lost credibility. They couldn't engage me in the conversation. And it wasn't that person's fault. It was the way they were trained and led. And they weren't trained in how do we engage the customer in a meaningful conversation. So again, we get back to the leadership problem.
Right, right. It seems consistent. And is that what you're part of what you're seeking to address in the Sales Executive Survival Guide?
Yeah. In the Sales Executive Survival Guide, we're looking at organizational excellence. Mm-hmm. How do we create and drive excellence within the sales function? How do we create and drive excellence within our enterprises and so on and so forth? And so there are a number of elements. The key elements are kind of culture, values, and talent. Mm-hmm. And those will take up about the culture and values takes up about 30% of it. And a lot of this actually comes from Peter Senge's work. He asked me who I look at.
All right.
Peter Senge's
work and learning, right.
Yeah, a lot of what he did is very fundamental to this kind of thing. Talent is another part of it. And then there's something that we call the sales execution framework. Mm-hmm. So often we get tunnel vision is we don't understand how the pieces, parts of the selling function fit together, both from a sales execution point of view, how do pipelines impact deal strategies, impact sales process, impact account strategies, and so on and so forth. And the fact is we got to do the whole job. Or how do I organize for success, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things. So the latter parts of the book really address kind of the overall organizational issues and the sales execution issues. Where this book is different than the Sales Manager Survival Guide is I don't present any solutions. I present things that you need to think about.
Think about, yeah.
And then it wraps up with this world of complexity. How do we manage complexity within our own organizations? And how do we recognize the complexity our customers are facing? And how do we help them simplify what they're doing?
Sounds fabulous. Sounds like much like Sales Manager Survival Guide. At least my perception is that there's a gap. There's a need for this type of a book. And the most important question we all want to know is when might we get our hands on it?
Well, hopefully, it's been 90% done for a couple of years, except I keep changing the 90%, but I've decided to lock and load it, and hopefully sometime this spring it'll come.
All right, fantastic. So that's great. Yep. All right, so last two questions here, and we're winding down. Greatest sales representative you've ever known?
Greatest sales leader I've ever
met. Okay.
And frankly, it's my wife. And I met my wife, she was IBM's top salesperson for a number of years. And she had a way of engaging customers that was just profound. She was both a very, very aggressive salesperson, but what came out in the way she engaged customers was that she really cared about them. Mm-hmm. Fast forward, she became a sales manager and a VP of sales in a hot technology company. And what became clear about her is she cared about her people. She cared about their success as salespeople and so on and so forth, to the degree that when you look at kind of what's your legacy as a leader, after she left technology and sales, she wanted to become a professional chef. She became a professional chef. She still had her people calling her up 10, 15 years later saying, you know, Cookie, I'm facing this challenge. They may have been CEOs. They may have been EVPs of sales. I'm facing this challenge. Do you mind if I walk you through it and you help me think about what I should be doing? And so you think is how many of us as leaders have people that we managed calling us up 10 to 15 years later, right, and asking for our help. So I think both as a salesperson, this vivid living, you know, walking the talk of saying, I care about you, my customer, or as a manager, I care about you, my people, because if I can help you become more successful, it makes me more successful.
What a great testament to your wife, and what a great inspiration for all of us. My last question here, and this is the one that always throws people a little bit. So you ready? So the New York Times Book Review dinner party question. I read the New York Times Book Review every week, and I always like when they interview the authors and they ask the question, hey, if you can have a dinner party, who are the, you know, the two or three people that you you invite to that dinner party, and what are you talking about?
That's a good question.
Yeah, it throws a lot of people. One guy said, I hope you can edit this out.
Yeah.
I like to know. It's an insight into you. So, you know, mine would be Drucker, Franklin, and I'm not sure on the third, probably Hemingway. What an interesting mix that is.
Yeah, I think I would opt towards Drucker would be one of mine, because he always engaged really at a philosophical level and really got you to think. I think I would look to, you know, some of the great military leaders. I look at a lot of the great, where I get some great lessons of things like General Mattis or Admiral, his name slips me. He's the one who did the University of Texas commencement speech that said, make your bed.
Uh-huh.
I'd look at somebody in the arts. I'd always like to meet like Twyla Tharp.
Oh, okay.
Because you look at, there's a book called How Artists Work.
Right.
And if you look at them, it's not just a random, you know, get up in the morning and be creative. There's a discipline to it. There's creativity, there's thinking, there's innovation, but there's a discipline and execution and practice. And I think if you know, I'm dedicated to what I call artful plagiarism.
Mm-mm.
Is if I can find great ideas, for instance, that Twyla Tharp does in creating these great productions and these great dances and so on and so forth. And I can take those and say, how do I adapt them to business? How do I adapt them to selling? That's where real innovation comes from.
Dave, I love that. What a fitting end to a great interview here, where you provide yet again really deep and thoughtful perspectives on those people. I have to thank you. I mean, just from beginning to end, this was fascinating. It's an honor for me to have had you here, and thanks for sharing your wisdom.
Oh, it's such a privilege. You know, I'm such a fan of your work and all that. So, I mean, I feel really honored being part of this, and particularly seeing the group that you've had before. I hope this lives up to the standard they set.
So. It has and will. So Dave, it's an honor. Thanks. I can't wait to talk soon.
Thanks so much.